And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Paul M. from El Cajon.
Paul Alcoholic. It's nice to be here. I thank Larry for asking me to share tonight. My sobriety date is January 17th, 1994. And, it's been an amazing ride. When I first got sober, there were a couple things that happened. One was I learned a couple things about what it meant to be alcoholic, and I learned some things about the description of alcoholism. And the first thing that comes to mind is something along the lines of it's like me taking this journey, like from San Diego to like Cleveland. I'm taking a journey from San Diego to Cleveland. But I'm like a tenth of a degree off. Right? That's my whole life I've been like this tenth of a degree off. And so by the time I get 5 years down the road, it's just a little bit off, but I'm still heading the right path. And by the time I get 10 years down the road, teachers are starting to tell me, hey, this guy's not living up to his potential. We need to straighten him out. Let's get back in line. By the time I get like 15 years down the road, heading for Cleveland, starting out a tenth of a degree off, I'm somewhere in Oklahoma City. I just start to veer off the course here, and by this time, judges and parents are saying, you need to straighten out a little bit. But I'm kind of like this defiant, self-reliant person that believes that I have a better idea and I can push my own path here, Either keep up or get out of my way type thing. And that's kind of my attitude. But unfortunately, if I left San Diego with a tenth of a degree off heading for Cleveland, I wound up in Tampa, Florida. And that's been kind of my life. And so it wound up to where judges were telling me that if I didn't kind of get in line with society, if I didn't kind of get in the flow of everybody else, that they were just going to put me away. They really don't care, my bright ideas really didn't mean anything. They were going to put me away. And so what happened is I was forced to do this. I don't do anything out of virtue. I absolutely, I don't take the steps out of virtue. I don't work with newcomers out of virtue. I don't come to speak in meetings like this out of virtue. Right? Because me, I'm just way so self-centered and so absorbed with me that I would much rather be sitting at home in my pool than sitting there talking to you guys. But unfortunately, this is what I have to do. This is exactly what I have to do. And my story starts out in Greenville, South Carolina. And the first drink I had was this bourbon, I think. My parents owned this telephone answering service. Back in the day before cell phones and pagers, you'd call up and the doctor, anyway. And my parents owned this telephone answering service, and they were getting a divorce. And so it was just my brother and I were supposed to answer these phones at night. And somehow, I'm like an 8-year-old kid here, right? And somehow my brother had gotten hold of this bottle of bourbon or whatever it was. And so that was my first drink. I didn't like the taste. I didn't like anything about it. I especially didn't like the effect of me, the puking. I didn't like that, But it set in motion something that, that I knew that I would feel many times before. And so my first actual drunk was, I think I was like 13 or 14 years old. I don't know if anybody ever did this when they were a kid, but kind of camped out in your backyard, made these makeshift tents, in the backyard. Right. Well, I was doing this, and I had this, I'd heard that if you would stick a straw in beer, and drink it, you'd get drunk. Right? And so that's all, and that's what was in my mind, is that if I would do this, and so my friend and I went into his dad's refrigerator, and what we wound up with was this Colt 45 malt liquor. Right? Who knew, And so I stuck the straw down this, down this Colt 45 malt liquor, and it changed me. It really changed me. I liked that. And next thing I know, I was... I got so carried away, and I started running around in circles and smacked right into a tree and right down. And it didn't stop me, Over and over again, I kept running into stuff, but that never stopped me from drinking. So this kind of progressed, and then in the early 70s, I would, you know, started smoking, you know, dope, marijuana, whatever, you know, and started drinking just on the weekends. I was in middle school, you know, so, you know, kind of a moderate drinker in the weekends, you know. You know, just kind of a moderate drinker. And the summer between middle school and high school, in the ninth grade, my friend decided that he wanted to experiment with these drugs. And me, I just want to fit in. You know, because this is the cool guy on the block, you know? You know, I want to hang out with him. And so he goes and gets this little bag of white powder. I had no idea. I have no experience with drugs whatsoever. And so he goes to get this little bag of white powder, and he sticks the tip of a knife blade in it and takes a snort and sets it down, you know? And so I do the same thing. Except what I know now is that I'm looking for instant gratification. And so I stuck that tip of the knife blade in and snorted it, and I didn't feel anything. So there was an ink pen sitting next to this thing, so I took the ink pen apart and stuck the whole pen down the bag, and all up my nose it went. And the next thing I know, it's 3 days later, and I'm waking up in this hospital, and I got tubes coming out of me that ought not be coming out of me, and it scared me to death. It literally scared me to death. It scared my family. And so for the next, I don't know, 4 years or so, I wouldn't even take so much as an aspirin. Wouldn't even take so much of an aspirin. But I did drink. And then from South Carolina, I moved up to a little farming community in northeastern Indiana. You know, nothing but cornfields. And so as this, and my life was progressing, we used to have these things called cornfield parties, right, where you just pick up a keg of beer, you know, a little pony, you know, a couple kegs of beer, and one guy had some wood in the back of his truck, and we'd drive down these country roads, and somebody would turn into somebody's cornfield and go right in the center of it, and that's where we hold the party, right, because, you know, we couldn't advertise it because the cops be out there, you know, and so, you know, and so I would walk around with this keg of beer on the back of me, you know, this little pony keg, and just serving beer, and more times than not, I would wake up the next morning in somebody else's cornfield. My car would just, you know, I just wake up in a cornfield. And so it just progressed. And then my very first DUI, I think I wasn't even 18 yet, but I was in Michigan. And I got a DUI in Michigan. And you know, it was just normal. And then the second DUI, which wasn't very far after that, I think it was about 22 when I got my second DUI. And what I discovered then, or what I thought then, is I better get out of this town. You know, after this, you know, and this DUI is still pending, you know. I mean, not now, but it was then. And so I thought maybe I better join the Navy. And it wasn't my idea to go join the Navy and serve my country and, you know, be a good guy. It was like, get the heck out of town. You know, like I say, I don't do anything out of virtue. You know, and in my mind, there's two things that a sailor does. Plays chess and drinks. You know, and I like doing both things. So the Navy seemed like a perfect fit. And so, I got to tell you, the whole 4 years in the Navy, never played one single game of chess. There's a lot of drinking. And so, you know, this Navy, everything just getting more progressive and more progressive. And the funniest story, or the story in the Navy, is that I think it was like 2 years in, and I got this letter from the American Red Cross that said my biological father had just died. You know, I haven't seen this guy, I didn't know him, you know. And my first response was I wadded this piece of paper up, threw it in the trash, and we were pulling out to sea. And then all of a sudden I got this bright idea. I get emergency leave. And so I took this piece of paper out of the trash can, smoothed it out, you know, put this sad face on and went over to the chief engineer and said, I got to go. And so they catapulted me off this Kitty Hawk. Right? So I spent the next month and a half or 2 months just bouncing around the world. And coming back to San Diego, and you know, and they were getting ready to throw me back in the brig here because you know I can't stay out of trouble, and so they sent me back, and I wound up in this place called Diego Garcia, just a little island in the middle of nowhere, and they wanted me to stay there, and my only job was to answer phones 4 hours a night. That's all they wanted me to do. And I couldn't even do that. So next thing I know, I'm being flown from there, and I have these orders in my hand that said, fly to Manila. Well, I mean, any sailor knows you fly to Manila and the ship's in Olongapo, right? You just different, anyway. So I have these orders in my hand, and I fly to Manila. And then as I'm driving from Manila to Olongapo, which, a couple-hour drive, the thought occurs to me that I had completed what these orders said. It just said, fly to Manila. It didn't tell me what to do afterwards. And so I just started partying for like 3 days, just partying. And it's a very, very unusual feeling to be standing at the end of a pier where there used to be a ship. There's supposed to be a ship there, right? And so these guys arrest me, and they charge me for a missing appointed place of duty. Right, and I'm just like this little E3 guy, nothing, and I'm getting all cocky, looking at this master at arms. And then I say to him, I said, how can I be charged with a misappointed place of duty when I wasn't given one? And this guy just turned red, because that was the facts. And that's how my life has been. I'm always on the edge. I'm always looking for ways around, through, but just always right on that edge and coming up with stuff so I can get out of it. That's how I live my life. And this guy got really pissed, but there's nothing he could do about it. I mean, how could you be charged with missing an appointed place of duty when right here it said fly to Manila and I flew to Manila? It didn't tell me what to do after that. So I'm just like a little lost sailor here, I had anyway. But that's kind of what the whole thing was all about, And so after the Navy, I barely got out of the Navy. I got to tell you that it's much easier to be catapulted off those aircraft carriers than it is to land on those things when you're hungover. It just wasn't fun because all it was just this little light, in the ocean, and all of a sudden this jet comes down and I'm all hungover, and it just wasn't fun. So I managed to get out of the Navy with basically only an exos mask the whole four years, because I just lucky. And out of the Navy, everything is getting progressively worse, right? It starts here, is that I took a job for a pizza place here in town. And so I'm starting to go to school, and there's this pizza place, and I'm the maintenance guy at this pizza place. And so what I would do is I had the keys and the combinations, And so I would go there and kind of help myself to the food, the pizza stuff, And then I discovered box wine, right, because they got box wine there. And I don't know about you guys, but, in More About Alcoholism, where it talks about only drinking natural wines, right, if it's got a screw cap, it's not natural. It's not natural. And this box wine was not natural, right? So, anybody here familiar with Boone's Farm Wine? Right. What about MD 2020 or, any of that stuff? That's how I got my start. Right. As a kid working in these stores. But, but that stuff's not natural. And, I had a bout with that stuff. And I don't know if you guys can relate to this, but the hangover hurts kind of back here. It just like your head just swells. This box wine is not right. And so that was it for the box wine, And see, and More About Alcoholism, it says we went from this to this to this to this, right? And so every time that I would kind of get tired of one wrestling match, I would always say it's the box wine's fault, or it's the vodka's fault, or it's the peppermint schnapps' fault. It was always something else. It was the rum really kicked my butt bad. Right? A Bacardi 151? Oh, man, that stuff kicked my butt bad. And so I would always just put that stuff away because I needed to have this delusion that I was in control. I always had to have something because I didn't want to be sloppy, falling down, drunk like my dad, like my real dad was. I didn't want to be like him. He was alcoholic, and that's the only thing I knew what alcoholic was my real dad. And so this Godfather's Pizza place, and then from there, I took a job at the Hotel Del. And again, going to school, everything is progressive. The education is progressing. The responsibilities are progressing. And the drinking is progressive. And at this Hotel Del, I was in charge of the power plant at nights. And in this power plant, you know, I worked nights, and most of the time I showed up drunk. Right? See, my wife never knew any of this stuff because, you know, I would leave for work and then stop at the bar and drink. And by the time, you know, I would go to work, I'd be drunk. And by the time I got home, I'd be sobered up. You know? And so there's one night here where I show up for work, and I'm just toast. And usually I can, kind of like sleep it off for a bit and then wake up in a few hours and do the work I'm supposed to do. You know? But this particular night, when I woke up, there was alarms and whistles going off everywhere. I looked out the window, and the generator was on fire. The generator's on fire. I was like, okay. Pretty sure I see a fire. And so I grab this fire extinguisher, go out there and put the fire out, you know, get things calmed down a little bit. But the Hotel Del is completely out of power. Right, we have utility, SDG&E, and this generator. So there's two forms of power, right? And both are dead because this fire knocked out everything. And so I'm able to get the generator up and running. Then up on top in the main control panel, there's this little button that you're supposed to push. Right, you're sitting there watching a clock, you know, a clock running, and you're supposed to push it when the dial gets straight up. Right. Well, I couldn't focus, and when I pushed this thing, it was like out. There's this large, big explosion. Right. I blew up the generator. Right. So the generator's gone. And I'm still groggy. You know. And then there's the mechanical means of closing the large breaker that'll bring the utility back to the hotel. So okay, I'm saved. You know. But my adrenaline is going on so much. My adrenaline is just going. I reach down, I start ratcheting this thing, and it comes off in my hand. So the hotel's dead, I'm drunk, and the bosses are coming in. Yeah? And you know, there's a part of this that I haven't told you yet, is that during my time at the Hotel Del, I started discovering, like, scrap copper, the wonders of scrap copper. You know? You find it everywhere, you know? Everywhere. And there just happened to be this huge pile of wire that was down in this place. And over the months that I worked there, I had been kind of skimming off the top of this copper, kind of taking it home, stripping it, because it's free money to drink on. And so by the time this happened, by the time I had blown up the Hotel Del, all this copper wire was gone, and that was supposed to be used for jumpers. The hotel's dead. There's no wire there to do a patch to get the utility back. I've broken the breaker. The generator's gone. I'm drunk. The bosses are coming in. And what type of what line am I going to walk now? Right? So the next job I had, I was surely gone from there. The next job, so you guys catching a little hint here? You know, I'm a thief. You know, I'm a drunken thief. You know, that's pretty much my story. Is that the next part of this is like this university in town. Right? This university I worked at, and I was their refrigeration guy and electrician. And one day I just happened to have this hankering, you know, and it was a nice warm summer day, kind of like today, right? And I went on top of the cafeteria and cut their heating system out. They didn't need the heat. It was a warm summer day. Who needs heat? All right. But the next day, I didn't have sense enough to wear different shoes. And I don't know if you guys ever walked on a roof, or some people have, you know, how you leave little footprints and sometimes you get little tar marks on your shoe. I didn't have the sense enough to wear different shoes the next day. So when they went back up there, I'm wearing the same shoes and there's the feet print. You know, so I'm guilty again. And so on and on and on, this happens over and over again. And it gets to a point to where my wife's friends have to call or have to lie about me being employed with them in order for me to get a job, because I have no references. Right? I can get a job, but I can't keep it. And what happened is this last job that I had when I was drinking was in this apartment building. I don't know, maybe you live there, I don't know. And I had the keys to these apartments. Right? You know, and I'm just a drunken thief. And I'm there for about 30 days. That's it. That's all it took. It's like 30 days. Things are just crashing hard. And so I'm going into these apartments and I'm stealing checks. I'm going to the bottom of these box of checks, all the way to the last book, last check, taking it out, getting a copy of the signature, and going to banks. And that's how I'm doing this. Because the problem that I had was I would always try to cover up one lie with another one over and over again. It's like I was supposed to be working these side jobs, but instead of working jobs, I'm in a bar drinking. And so not only would I have to make up the money I'm supposed to be earning while actually working, I need to make up the money that I'm spending. And this cycle just keeps repeating itself over and over again, and I can't do anything about it. So I come up with all these schemes, right? And I don't know how many times people screwed me over with money, or so I told my wife. You know, it was always their fault. It was always their fault. And it got to the point, I'm kind of a mechanical-minded kind of guy, that I rigged up this system that every day at like 5, 6 o'clock, the phone in my house would shut off. Right? It was a timer, you know, because in my mind, if that phone were turned off, I was going to have a nice, peaceful night. Creditors weren't going to call. These people that I was screwing over on these jobs were not going to call. You know, and I don't know if you guys remember those late night fights that you used to have. I hated those. You know? And so, in my mind, it had nothing to do with drinking, but in my mind, if I could just shut that phone off, then life would be okay today. It'd be nice and quiet. You know, they would leave me alone. And during this same time period, my wife and I went to this marriage counselor, if you can imagine that. And in this marriage counselor, it's like early 90s, I thought for sure I had this guy convinced that it was her fault. I was 100% sure because, you know, I can articulate. I'm a con, right? You know, I thought for sure that I had convinced this guy that all these troubles we were having were her fault. And so as we're walking out the door of the very last visit, he kind of slides a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous at me. And I just looked at this thing and said, I'm not going to read this. You know, there's no pictures in this book. It's too big. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to read it. It didn't apply to me. The only thing it said was alcohol. I said, okay. And so it sat on my coffee table, you know, just for show, right? For a long time. And what I would do is you know, there was long periods of time where I was unemployed, you know, because I couldn't keep a job, and so I would always find a way to get a 12-pack of beer, you know, whatever it was, you know, I always find a way to get a 12-pack of beer and drink during the daytime. And then be able to clean the mess up before my wife got home, you know, and make sure the cans were not in the house. They were somewhere else, you know, because that's the proof. You know, and what I would do with this big book sitting on the coffee table is I would sit there watching TV or playing some stupid video game and build this pyramid above this book of beer cans. Imagine that. Who would have known that book was going to save my life one of these days? But that's kind of how this, you know, that's kind of how this happened. To get back to this employer thing here, when I had stole these checks and gone to these banks to cash them, there was one bank that I knew was going to call and verify funds, verify that this check was indeed written to me and it was in the proper amount. Yeah, I knew that going into that bank, and in hindsight, I think it was like I called the cops on myself. You know, I don't think anybody's ever done that, but that's kind of what I felt like, you know, just calling the cops on myself, like, help me, you know. And so the cops came, but they didn't cash the check. And the next morning I went back to work in this apartment complex, and the owner of the building was there, my boss was there, and they gave me my last check, and they said that, they said, the cops are coming to get you, you got to go. And so I went home. And I told my wife in the house that was being foreclosed on that I got to go. And that was January 15th, 1994, January 16th, 1994. And I went out and I just partied my butt off for that night. And I'm sitting there on the streets of San Diego at night. And every time I would take a hit and every time I would drink, I would say, I'm going to treatment tomorrow. because I knew that I needed to go somewhere to figure out how to get out of this one. And I needed time to think about this one because I'm pretty sure I'm going to prison. You know? And as I'm sitting there, January 16th, 1994, in early morning, I'm in Balboa Park hitting this pipe, and the Northridge earthquake hits. Right? And it just shook my truck. And, you know, I really didn't smoke a whole lot of crack. You know, that's kind of like the first, you know, first couple times. And I'm thinking, holy crap, where's this stuff been my whole life? my whole truck just shook. Wow. And then and every time I would do that, I would say, I'm going to Tremont tomorrow. And so I wound up at API. And where's Debbie at? Debbie? Debbie and I were in API together. Yeah. Congratulations, 14 years. And so that's where I wound up, was in this API. I had no intentions of getting sober. None. Right? It was the furthest thing from my mind. Right? Because it was your fault. It was always somebody else's fault. If I could just arrange you, if that phone would just shut off, if the bosses would just listen to me, you know, if the price of copper would go up, I'd be really good. That's kind of how I thought. And I'm sitting in there in that treatment center. The earthquake had knocked out phone lines, knocked out everything. So it was just dead. And I'm sitting there one morning looking out over Interstate 8, and the world's going by, and you don't care if I'm a dead or alive. The world doesn't care if I'm here. You know, and that was my first spiritual awakening, honestly, is the world's going to continue whether I'm here or not. And in this treatment center, what I learned was one thing and one thing only. You know, they shoved us in these buses and they went, took us to little places like this, and I just heard Charlie Brown's Teacher. You know, that's all I heard. But in this treatment center, I learned one thing and one thing only about this phenomenon of craving. And regardless of the psychobabble stuff that was coming out of your mouth, regardless of the AA dogma that exists around here, regardless of all that stuff, I could not dispute that one fact. When I start to drink, I can't guarantee how much I'm going to drink. And I got really scared because my biological father had died from this disease. My grandfather died from this disease. And I saw my mother's face with her finger pointing at me, "You're just like your father." And I knew I had it, and I couldn't dispute it. What do I got to do to treat it? And all the answers I was getting it didn't make any sense to me. It was just dogma. You know, I was in this treatment center, and a guy came in, and I was really eager, scared, you know, wanting to learn this stuff to figure out what I got to do. And the guy says, "There's only one thing you got to change." And so my ears perk up. Okay, this is what I need to hear. And he says, "You got to change everything." And I took this guy out, literally took him out of the room and backed him up against the wall and told him, "How dare you come in here to a place like this and tell us this stupid stuff? What is the answer here? I want this thing and I want it now. I don't want to be your baby. I don't want to be your pigeon. I don't want to be nothing like that. I don't want to be your petri dish. Tell me what I need to do and leave me alone." And that was my attitude. Some people took that for anger. I don't know. when I got sober, I stuttered. And I still stutter a little bit now. You know, yeah, right. So I still stutter now. But when I first got sober, I couldn't talk. And these hairy legged, tattooed, pierced up guys were, you know, shoving these phone numbers at me, telling me to call them every day. I can't talk. And they want me to call them. What for? He said, "You know, I don't want this stuff." And what happened the first 10 days of my sobriety, I got into this recovery home, Pathfinders Recovery Home.
Yeah.
And what happened there, the cops were still out to get me. You know, the cops were still looking for me. And so I went to this recovery home and started learning a few things, and I knew I had this allergy, right? And I want to fix this thing. I'm not going to do this again. This is the only time I'm going to do this. I want the correct information. But I had this legal thing hanging over my head. And so what I did is on my 30th day of sobriety, I went down to the Lemon Grove Sheriff Station and turned myself in. And I went in there and told them my name and told them, you know, you're investigating the case, and obviously I'm the guilty one. I'm here I'm here to turn myself in. And the lady behind the counter said, there's nobody here, you got to come back later. And so, true story. And so then what happened is I went back out to my truck, and I sat there. And at that moment is when I sincerely understood the first step. That it's not a question of if I'm going to drink or use. The question is when. My history shows that regardless, wife, no wife, job or no job, right, whether you want me to or not, whether the a necessity or the wish, I'm going to drink again. And at that moment, sitting in that truck, I conceded that something's got to change. I can't do this. And I walked back in there and turned myself in and said, I'll just wait. And so since then, it was like, you know, I spent a couple days in jail, and they took, you know, sent me back to the recovery home. And in that recovery home, I got really, really anxious and, you know, kind of worried. You know, I don't know about, you know, a newcomer at 6 months sober, right? Remember how that was? Just, you know, coming apart at your seams because I have no spirit in me. I've got no alcohol or drugs in to fix me. It's just me and this empty shell of a man and nothing I can do about it. Nothing I can do about it. I'm just stuck. And I'm sitting there squirming in my hands and basically yelling at people saying, I'm not hearing anything here. And I heard a guy from the podium say, when the book says to pray, you pray. When it says to write, you write. When it says to talk to somebody else, you do that. And so I picked up this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and started reading it. And in there, I found the solution to my problem. And the foreword to the first edition answered most of the questions on how to read the book. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely, and precisely is in italics, how we've recovered is the main purpose of this book. Now, this is my first time getting sober. I have not been influenced by the dogma in the rooms. I've not been influenced by all the sayings and the cliches. Right? I'm not brainwashed by the fellowship yet. Right? So I took this book for precisely what it said. I read it like a third grader because that's kind of like my reading level at the time. And when it said that I was going to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, I took it to mean I got hope. I got hope, and that's what I want. I want hope. And so I just followed along, and I understood that that book was a diary, that book was a journal. I'm not part of we. Nobody in this room is part of we in that book. That is the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is unity. This is fellowship. But the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous is described in the big book, period. And it says it's going to tell me precisely how to recover. And so the only thing I did is I followed along. Right? And the first 43 pages of that book is the first half of the first step. And it describes two things. When I start to drink, can I guarantee how much I'm going to drink? And I have this body that doesn't metabolize alcohol correctly. And how I know that is because I like water. You know, water's good. But I can guarantee you that after finishing this water, I'm not going to go out and buy a case of water to get me through the night. I can guarantee you that. But around whiskey, around beer, right? I need more of this to get me through the night, right? So that answers that question specifically, 100%. I have a body that doesn't metabolize alcohol correctly, and it doesn't matter what I think when I start to drink, I'm going to close the bar down. On Tuesday night when I start to drink, I have every intention of going home, whether it's a fight at home or not, I have every intention of going home and being at work the next morning. That's not what happened. Chances are I closed the bar down. But if that were the only issue I have, then I would be able to just say no and everything would be okay. But I can't, because I have this mind that will rationalize and justify its way back into the next drink regardless. That if I just have beer, I'll be okay. Maybe throw in a little bit of crystal meth here because, you know, I want to get those DUIs. All right? And next thing you know, I'm still in jail, but this time instead of passed out, I'm wide awake. That's my story, you know? But the second part of this is what really ties the knot here in the first step, is that when I'm stone cold sober, why can't I stay that way? When, if given sufficient reason, why can't I stop and stay stopped? See, I got this other thing going on, this thing on the inside, And the best description of that is that my mind would have killed my body years ago, but it needed it for transportation. I have this mind that will talk me into it, regardless of what she says, the boss says, regardless of blowing up the Hotel Del or whatever, you know. I'm going to rationalize myself into that next drink. I'm powerless. Second step is just a question. Am I willing to believe there's a power greater than me? The first step, if I understand that correctly, I don't have to write about it, I don't have to tell you about it, I just got to feel it deep down where I live. And that second step is just a question. Am I willing to believe there's a power greater than me? I certainly hope so. You know, the book uses the term that lack of power is our dilemma. We have to find a power by which we can live. So what is the definition of a dilemma? I have two or three choices and all of them are terrible. All of them are terrible. So lack of power, it doesn't matter what I think. I can't think my way out of powerlessness. It doesn't matter. My history proves 100% that I'm going to drink again. Now, my delusion is that if I find that right balance, I'll be good. You know, find that right balance of this and that and, you know, whatever, you know, I'll be good. You know, but the reality of it is that's just not so. And so what I had to do here was, if I'm willing to believe there's a power greater than me, what am I going to do about it? And this big book is very clear. First thing I have to do is I have to look at my prejudice. And I'm prejudiced against a lot of things, especially when I first got sober. When I first walked into these rooms, there were a lot of people with tattoos and piercings, you know, right? In the place where I grew up, Indiana, northeastern Indiana, at that time, my stepdad said, "You got a tattoo, you're either drunk or stupid." And so I walked into these rooms, and what do I see? Tattooed, pierced up people. And what I had to do was I had to close my eyes. I just had to close my eyes and listen to the message, try to hear the message, and not look at the messenger. And I heard some amazing stuff around here. The steps go something like this. The first step is two questions. When I start to drink, can I guarantee how much I'm going to drink? The second question is, was I given sufficient reason to stop? It's not a question of if I'm going to drink. The question is when. This is my experience. The second step is a question as well. And I'm a recovering Southern Baptist, and this was very difficult. The second step is a question, and only a question. It says, as soon as a man can say he's willing to believe or does believe, we emphatically assure him he's on his way. The entire purpose of this program, the entire purpose of that book, is to enable me to find a power that's going to solve my problem. Period. My problem, alcohol. Not my inability to form a true partnership with another human being. Right? None of that psychobabble stuff. Alcohol. Period. So the second step is a question, but I have to lose some of these prejudices. And I'm not willing to lose these prejudices because I'm still driven by old ideas. I'm still driven by me. I only see the world through my eyes. I can't see them through your eyes or anybody else's eyes. I'm chained to me and my experiences, and I can't do anything about it. But alcohol persuaded me that maybe I need to find something. So the first thing I did was I used a group. I used a group of drunks. Because the book told me, and I heard in these rooms, that God will speak through you. And so I listened into these rooms, and what I saw was a bunch of men and women. And there's some men here. There's some men in this room who you can look in their eyeballs, and you can tell that happiness deep down within. And that attracted me. Not what was coming out of their mouth. It's that deep down thing. Because, because I'm a con guy. You know, my job is to read people and to figure out what your twists are and take advantage of them. That's me. But when I looked in these guys' eyes, they had something. And it was peace. Internal peace. And I wanted some of that. And all of them had one thing in common. That they had taken the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not somebody's version of 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. From the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the recovery program. There are many programs out there. The fellowship has a 2% success rate in staying sober. The Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous has a 75% chance of staying sober. There is a guarantee in the book. So what would I prefer? To follow the herd and maybe get catapulted off a cliff? Or would I want to go with something that has been proven and true? This is my life. I live in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can ask my wife. She'd get tired of that shit. I'll say this in closing. In the forward to the second edition, there's some things called the tenets of the Oxford Group, right? And I believe they were like the first six steps of the program. There's things called the tenets of the Oxford Group, and this is how my mind thinks, and this is how I live, try to live. Is in the first one, it was like we look at ourselves and not other people. We do inventory. The second one is I confess my defects. The third one is I make restitution to people I've harmed. And the fourth one is I help other people. And the next one is I believe in something greater than me. And if I were to put those in language of a third grader, it's Paul, don't be a tattletale. Worry about yourself. And when you break that window, you got to tell somebody and you got to pay for it. And then you got to depend on something else other than you. And how about help that old lady across the street? So these are the principles that I've been taught my whole life, but I'm a tenth of a degree off. I don't want to listen to you. I don't want to listen to what's even close to being right, because I'm going to beat my own path. And what the 12 steps are, the 12 steps are guides to this, because I'm not wired to think about anybody or what I've done to anybody else. I'm only wired to think of what you've done to me. So these 12 steps are guides to this process. And what I've discovered in my time of sobriety is that I can be happy, unemployed. You know, it doesn't matter. The illness that I have is not external. People, places, and things do not get me drunk. Because if I remove from people, places, and things, what do? I just find more people, places, and things. Right? I mean, that's what I do. Because they always just say, if you just stop hanging out with that crowd, you'd be okay. Once I stopped hanging out with that crowd, I just found another crowd. The illness I have is not external. It has nothing to do with people. It has nothing to do with places. It has to do with my relationship with the Spirit. And in my case, I'm going to treat what I have with the Spirit or with the Spirit. I'm going to find the Spirit vodka, or I'm going to find another Spirit, but I will treat what I have. I don't have a choice. That's what it means to be powerless, is that I have this spiritual void and I'm going to seek a Spirit. I don't have a choice in this matter. So if you're new in this program, and a lot of this stuff sounds like Charlie Brown's teacher, right, pick up this big book and be accountable for your own recovery. Be accountable for your own recovery. If you're interested in saving your life. You know, because people die from this thing all the time. And I thank Larry for asking me to share, and thank you very much.